This paper is based on a, well, the presentation, I should say, is based on two papers, one of which is more developed than the one with Xavier, but what we're, and the other one is with Kalina Zhukova in the audience there and Jack Holland. And it's part of a, both of those papers are part of a project that looks at the discursive construction of R2P in the official, Western official discourse, and by West we're focusing on the P3, UK, France, and US. The discursive construction of R2P in the official and non-official, essentially newspaper editorials, construction of the meaning of R2P in that discourse on Syria in the initial, what we call the initial phase of the Syria crisis, 2011 to 2013. And this idea that R2P, there are various meanings of R2P in the discourse, is trying to build on the work, the international relations theoretical work of people like Anchovina, Amitav Achaya, that have argued in what they call a reflexive constructivist or a critical constructivist approach, have argued that norms like R2P do not have a fixed meaning. And this is, this kind of argument is made in a critique of what might be called conventional constructivist, the norms life cycle literature, that we start with a norm, the meaning is fixed, and it progresses through a life cycle of implementation to an end point where states observe the R2P. Critical constructivists or reflexive constructivists say that's too linear, and it's based too much on the idea that a norm is fixed. Then, in fact, if you look at how the norm is used in discourse, there can be various meanings of a norm in use at any one time. So our papers, one with Xavier and one with Kalina, illustrate this, like I say, with respect to the initial phase of the Syria crisis. So we've done a discourse analysis of official statements, all UK newspapers, with a search of search terms used in Syria, R2P and intervention. If you want to know how many articles that is something over 2,000 articles we've looked at in all UK newspapers. We've looked at New York Post and Washington Times on the US side. That's the less developed paper. To look at the meaning of R2P in use. And what I just want to do now is illustrate, I guess, three interesting findings. Whether they're important or not, I'll leave them to you, but they're interesting to me at least. The first is that there remains, and this is the less significant one, I think, we kind of know this, there remains a view in the discourse that R2P authorises military intervention without UN Security Council authorisation. And now, if you say that the UN World Summit Outcome Document is the meaning of R2P, then this is wrong. The World Summit Outcome Document clearly states that military intervention, coercive measures, Pillar 3 measures have to go through the Security Council. I think there's some confusion here with the British Foreign Office view of the doctrine of humanitarian intervention, which is an argument that humanitarian crises can authorise. But that's a humanitarian intervention, it's not an R2P. In a public discourse, this confusion is still there. I think it's of interest here because, or it perhaps wasn't clarified so much in the official discourse, the difference between humanitarian intervention and R2P. Because, of course, the British government, following the American government, had no interest in this initial phase in intervening militarily in Syria. So this confusion, if you like, this meaning in use wasn't necessarily as significant, although it did become significant towards the end of our period with the chemical weapons. And there were some people arguing there that we can intervene under R2P or under humanitarian intervention without UN Security Council authorization. So that's the first finding, if you like. I think the more significant one, for me at least, is in the discourse there was a fusion, not a confusion, but a fusion of R2P, of the protection discourse with R2P. There was a fusion with a democracy promotion discourse, a discourse of political transition in Syria to democracy, and ultimately regime change. The phrase regime change wasn't used very often, if at all, certainly not in official discourse, because that had resonance with Libya, and Syria is not Libya, they kept telling us. But nonetheless, there was this fusion of R2P with the Assad must go rhetoric and what was called political transition to democracy. And you get kind of off the cuff remarks, I think. You know, I think William Hague, Foreign Secretary, probably wasn't thinking too much about this. And it's a bit unfair for an academic 6 years later to pick this up. But he did use the phrase around April 2011 of the responsibility, Assad must observe the responsibility to protect democratic protesters. Now that was before crimes against humanity. So what had responsibility to protect got to do with Syria? Well, here there was a responsibility to protect the right to peaceful protest. Now, as a human rights, supporter of human rights and a liberal, I'd say that's true. But R2P is about humanitarianism and crimes against humanity. Human rights is about a liberal political discourse. But in Western discourse, these were confused. In the first resolution that was vetoed, the October 2011, vetoed by Russia and China, if you study that resolution, what do you find are references to R2P? Syria has a responsibility to protect its population. Pillar one, we all agree with that. But if you look at down the resolution, how should Syria fulfill its responsibility to protect? It should take measures for a political transition that's inclusive of all elements of Syrian society. In other words, a liberal democratic process. Now again, I have no problems with that as a liberal, but is this fusion of a liberal discourse of human rights and democracy promotion with R2P necessarily what R2P means? It certainly wasn't what R2P means for Russia and China, because they vetoed it. They saw it as R2P leading to regime change, and we'd already had regime change in Libya, and by 2012 we were getting radicalization and ISIS in Libya. So they vetoed it. Now, what was sustaining this fusion of R2P and the liberal democracy promotion agenda was, of course, the Arab Spring discourse, or the Arab Spring rhetoric. Because, of course, the trouble in Syria in this early phase was operating in the context of Gaddafi falling, of Egypt, of Tunisia before that, and a sense that there was very little cost in calling for Assad to go. The discourse is replete with references to the Assad regime is doomed, it's a matter of time, that we're on the right side of history. I mean, that's one of Obama's favorite sayings, the arc of history. Well, again, that's okay, and in the long term, that probably will be true. But in the meantime, we're getting violence that is reaching a level of crimes against humanity, which is... So what I'm saying is the democracy promotion agenda and the Arab Spring agenda worth the cost of a crime against humanity? Now, what does this mean for R2P? Let me just step back a little bit there. This is not just a critical academic saying this at this time, saying this. At the time, you had, of course, the Annan peace process in 2012. And if you read the reflections of Jean-Marie Guaheno, who was Annan's advisor in Syria at that time, he argued that all of the Security Council members were responsible in part for the collapse of the Annan plan, and that, of course, was Annan's public position. But he also says that some states were more interested in a democratic transition, were more interested in the overthrow of the Assad regime than they were in preventing war. And the implication there is that the Annan plan could have succeeded if Western powers had delinked it from political transition. So how does that then relate back to R2P? Well, if R2P, the meaning and use of R2P, is linked to the democracy promotion agenda, and this is the other side of the title, from meanings and use to useful meanings. If R2P meant political transition, and if political transition meant the prolonging of a war in which crimes against humanity occurred, then that particular meaning in use of R2P was in fact useless. Now, what does that mean for general reflections on R2P? It doesn't, in my mind, mean R2P failed. It just means a particular interpretation of R2P in that particular situation at that particular time did not protect the Syrian people. However, and Jess might talk about this in a moment, there are other interpretations of R2P that were in use at that time but weren't adopted necessarily by governments. And what we've tried to do in the paper, I hope I'm not stealing your thumb here, is R2P could mean humanitarian access. Humanitarian access that might be guaranteed if you drop the Assad must go rhetoric. So I guess what we're saying here is I think R2P, in implementing the norm, we need to take a pragmatic view of the situation on a case-by-case basis. And we need to be careful how R2P, and Anne-Marie made this point yesterday, we need to be careful how R2P gets adopted and fused with other discourses, whether it be the democracy promotion agenda, the counter-terrorism agenda, because ultimately, even the international criminal justice agenda, right? So I think there is a clear fusion of R2P and ICC. And we can all see the logic that the perpetrators of ethnic cleansing should be punished in the long-term interests of a protection agenda. But what was the use, what was the usefulness of putting a resolution down, alienating the Russians and China, putting a resolution down to refer the situation to Syria, further alienating the Russians and Chinese, knowing that that resolution would never pass? It would demonstrate, oh, we've tried our best to be R2P consistent, but what was the use in protecting the vulnerable people at that time? Wouldn't it have been more useful to make pragmatic compromises, and this is the political realism, and this was what happened in Bosnia, right? If you look at how the international community ended the Bosnian war, they sat down and talked with the people who were accused of ethnic cleansing, Milosevic, Mladic, Karadzic, and it brought an end to the conflict and ethnic cleansing stopped, the Dayton Accords. It was later that they then prosecuted Mladic, Karadzic. So it gets into the peace justice, and now, again, this could be seen as unfair because I realise this is political judgment, and it's easy in a conference room 6 years later to say that, to say this. But I guess what I'm calling for amongst the R2P scholars is to recognise that implementing R2P is a matter of political judgment, and to be sensitive to the fact that politicians are having to make very difficult judgments, but ultimately be able to say, well, I can still criticise the political judgment that you made. Linda.